Turn the session over to Jeff Brewer from the Army Corps of Engineers, who will be serving as the official session moderator. Jeff, please feel free to begin.
All right, thank you. Again, my name is Jeff Brewer. I'm with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Center of Expertise here in Huntsville, Alabama. And I'd like to welcome everybody to our third M2S2 webinar of this year. And this webinar is accident reporting. Now, we've only got three speakers today. And I'd like to remind everybody that coming up in February, it should be our next webinar if we can get it scheduled in correctly sometime in mid-February, and that is going to be on the it's the MR QAP toolkit that's coming out for those of you who are interested in it, and I'll be putting out advertisement for that. So with all that being said, I'd like to introduce Kelly Williams from the Corps of Engineers Huntsville Center, and her presentation is going to be on accident reporting. So with that being said, it's all on you, Kelly.
Thank you, Jeff, and good afternoon, everybody. As Jeff said, my name is Kelly Williams. I'm the Chief of Safety at Huntsville Center. Just to give you a little background on me, I've been working in the safety and occupational health arena for over 30 years. 27 of those years I've been with the Corps of Engineers here at Huntsville Center. During this time, I've supported the OE programs, both the conventional and chemical warfare material programs, in one capacity or another. And I've also supported many of the other programs that we have here at Huntsville Center in the Installation Support Directorate. I've been the Chief of Safety for a little over 2 years now. So today I was asked to discuss the mishap reporting requirements as required by the Corps of Engineers. As required by the Corps of Engineers and the U.S. Army. So for about the next 45 minutes, I'm going to try to discuss mishap reportings in accordance with USAFE's requirements. So what I will talk about is the proper forms, the timelines that you need to adhere to, several lessons learned from recent Huntsville accidents, to include three Board of Investigations from serious accidents, and then three mishaps that occurred on ordnance and explosive sites. I'll talk about how we report lessons learned, and then I'll conclude with a summary of HNC contractor accidents to give you a summary of what has happened in FY18. Trying to get used to changing the slides. I apologize for a little rough start here. Okay, so most importantly, all mishaps for the Corps of Engineers are reportable, and it's really the format and the timelines that change, and that really depends on the severity of the mishaps. So the information that I'm going to talk about today comes from two references that you should remember. You guys all probably know EM38511, and right now we're under the one that was dated 30 November 2014. If you go to section 01D, that's where most of the mishap reporting requirements come from. But sprinkled throughout that section 1, it talks about the requirements for training and what kind of awareness training each individual needs to have, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. Then we also have the engineering regulation ER 385-1-99, and that's the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Accident Investigation and Reporting Regulation. The latest version of that is in 2010, so it's a little dated, but it still has some really good information that you should look at. So before I get too much further into the actual reporting requirements, I do want to highlight what some of the training requirements are for mishap reporting and investigation found in both of these documents. If you look in Section 3.2 of the engineering regulation, it discusses what to investigate and report, and what the training requirements are for both supervisors and the site safety and health officer. You go to Section 3-4, it details what non-reportable events are. For example, property damage as a result of vandalism, riots, civil disorders or something like an arson event, that's non-reportable. Or if you have property damage that occurs after property has been stolen, that again is non-reportable. So if you're not sure and you're on site, the ER is a great document to go to that talks about different things that occur, because accidents aren't always real clear-cut. If you go to Appendix C, it also talks about reporting requirements per 1904, but I recommend going to OSHA reporting requirements on that because, like I said, the ER hasn't been updated since 2010, so it's a little outdated in that respect. But both references discuss that employees, supervisors, and the site safety and health officers are all required for some degree of training for accident investigation and reportings. And it's important that this is done up front in the indoctrination training so that everybody knows what they're required to do in the unfortunate event that an accident does occur. They're ready and prepared to fulfill their requirements. Indoctrination training is required to include a discussion for both employee and supervisor responsibilities for both the reporting and for the investigations. Per the EM, the person conducting the training for the indoctrination and training should be competent in these subjects, so they need to know what the requirements are and how they train the both the supervisors and the employees on these requirements. They need to know what the USACE requirements are, where the correct forms are required, where they're located, what the timelines are for reporting, and who to report the information to depending on the type of accident that occurs or incident, and be trained in the proper way to investigate an accident. A lot of times we get accident reports from 3394s that don't give us the complete information that we need for our statistics and for our lessons learned. So the trainer needs to know that the accident investigation shall be recorded on the 3394. For Huntsville Center, we have Revision 2. There's other revisions out there, but we'd like to see it on Revision 2. This form has the specific fields that we need to complete this the information on that. But prior to completing the 3394, the contractor must complete a preliminary accident notification and send the information to the POC that's identified in the scope of work. For Huntsville Center, our GDA that's referred to in EM3511 is the contracting officer or the project manager. I recommend that you look in your scope of work and know who that is. It should be defined who it is for that. But if you don't know, it's a good idea to send it to the KO, to the PM, and probably to the safety representative if you know who all three of those are. Accidents in the Corps of Engineers and for other purposes are investigated for lessons learned. They're used to share with all workers and contractors to help ensure that similar accidents don't occur. So we really need to make sure we have the proper information on all those forms. Okay, this slide talks about the mishap. What is the definition of a mishap in accordance with EM38511? It's pretty simple. Basically, like I said, any incident that happens during the course of work being performed has to be reported in some cases. The ones that I'm going to talk about today are recordable, high hazard, first aid cases, and near misses. Those all have a type of reporting that has to be done and timelines that have to be met. All right, so here's the definitions of a recordable. If you look in the ER, it talks about a recordable meets any of the classes A through E. If you go to Class E, that talks about aviation accidents, and I'm not going to talk about that today. For what the Corps of Engineer does for 99% of the time, it's going to be a Class A through a Class D accident. The most important thing on this slide are these are the type of accidents that we put in our DART rates that we have to give up to headquarters. What differentiates these, I think the cutoff, I mean, they each have a dollar amount. You start at a threshold of $5,000 for a Class D, and then you go on up as you go up there, on up, and then if it's a, depends if you have a days away or not, and you can read what's in red there. But if you look at a Class C and a Class D, those are recordable. You have to do the 3394. When you start getting into a Class B, that meets the threshold of a Board of Investigation, which means there's a lot more requirements that we have to do given that. So that's when the difference is there. So for Huntsville Center, in accordance with ER 3851-99, we have a preliminary accident notification form. Some other districts and divisions have different ways for you to notify them, but this gives Huntsville Center the preliminary information that they need to start the accident process into EngLink. You can find this worksheet on our safety office internet, and I've got the link there at the bottom of the slide. So during the development of your accident prevention plan, it's really important that you determine what method of notification is for whatever district you're working for and ensure that in your accident prevention plan you define that so all your on-site workers are aware of that. A lot of times we don't get this information and we don't get it in a timely manner, or they might just record it on their daily log, but it's important that we have this and there's timelines associated with it. Just for information, USACE is in the process of updating our 3394, our accident reporting form, which I'll show you in a minute. And when it's finalized, if it's in the format that it is now, it will be a universal form for all mishap reporting to include preliminary notification, recordable, high hazards, near misses. So it should be able to be one form that we give out that all districts and divisions are using for all classes or types of accidents. So I think that will simplify the process for that. And the last date I heard on that to be finalized is the March-April 2019 timeframe. I'm not sure if that's going to, you know, hold fast, but that's what they're saying right now for that. When you look at the preliminary accident notification form on here, it has some information like date of birth. I don't need any PII on here, and if it's not blanked out, it should be. We'll talk about that later, but those kind of things don't need to be on there. Just the form hasn't been updated yet, and we're waiting for that new 3394 to come out. Any questions on that should be directed to your contracting officer when you get that contract. Okay, so here's the version that Huntsville Center uses for the 3394. Important, I know this sounds pretty simplistic, but it's important that you fill it out completely and accurately. Attach all the information that needs to be attached. The form provides more specific information than the PAN that we just talked about. So I can't tell you how many times we get information that's either not legible, it's not completely filled out, they leave blanks, they say it says, you know, attach something and it's not attached, and then we just have to send it back. And again, this is what we use for our accident statistics, and the information is used to determine what we need to change in the EM or what we need as a more of an emphasis. So if we don't have accurate information, it's hard to make informed decisions based on stuff that we don't have good information on. So it's really important that this form is filled out completely and accurately. On the next slide, you'll see I just took a screenshot of the backside of the 3394, and some of the things that I see all the times that aren't being filled out are, you know, if you look in B up on the top right, do you have an AHA for the job? Yes, and attach a copy, but they don't attach the copy. If the answer is no, well, should there have been one? If there should, then you should say, as you know, part of the actions taken is we completed one. Sometimes you're not going to have an AHA for every little thing on site, but if it is a task that needs to have one, you should say no, but as part of the actions taken, we've done that, and you go from there. Was a person trained in the activity? And then you talk about that and fill it out. If it was yes, then you go to B, and then you go to C. Again, I know it's simplistic, but these are things we don't get when we get our 3394s, and it takes time to go back and forth with the contractor to get this information. And then in 13, you know, the meat of it is what's the direct cause, the indirect cause, and what are you doing to eliminate the hazard from happening again, or the accident from happening again. Okay, I try to bring this up in any forum that I can talk to contractors, because we still have issues with this. There's a definition of both of those on there. We don't need any PII or PHI, if not only in accident reporting, but if you're sending in medical. All I need to know is that the person has been evaluated in accordance with the regulation that a doctor finds him fit to wear a respirator. Or in this case, I don't need to know the birth date of the individual or the Social Security number. And again, the forms are a little outdated, so it has it on there, but we've tried to say leave blank in most of those. So you are, by federal law, you're required to protect your employees' PII and PHI. So be cognizant of that and try not to send this to us. We don't need that information. All right, I want to spend just a couple of minutes on timeline. A lot of times we don't get the accident reports in a timely manner. If you look at ER 3851-99, from the time a mishap occurs till the 3394 is signed, we have 45 days to get all the information gathered and to have it signed. You would think that would be simple, and there shouldn't be a problem with that. We generally don't meet that timeline. Huntsville Center, and this is just Huntsville Center alone, has done a work instruction where we required a little sooner than that. And if you look up on the top line, you'll see from the time the mishap occurs, we have a requirement to get it done within 12 days to get to Huntsville Center to do the signing of it. If you look down on the box on the bottom, it says who needs to sign it. And for Huntsville Center, we do it a little differently again, is that on line 15 of the 3394, that's for the contractor. Love to have the corporate safety do it, the PM or somebody in charge. Sometimes I don't get that. But that's who I'd like to see, that the corporate safety has looked at it and done some quality control on that before they send it forward. Then we have four lines in Huntsville Center that it has to go through. It has to go through the division chief, the director, the chief of safety, and then finally up to the commander. So that takes a while to get done. So that's why Huntsville Center wants it, one of the reasons that they want it a little bit sooner than 45 days. So again, the 45 days by regulation is to have it signed. What you have to do is, some of the reporting requirements is, when you have a mishap, if it's a Class C or lower, you have 24 hours to notify the GDA. From there, if you have a high hazard, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, or a Class A or a Class B accidents, you actually need to do immediate notification. I encourage you to pick up the phone and call, and then back it up with an email. And, you know, like sometimes we'll get the contractor to send it to the PM, but I would recommend that you try to send it to the PM, the KO, and to the safety, if you know who that is, just so they can get it. Sometimes an accident occurs on a weekend, on a holiday, or when that PM isn't there, and it's just good to know, because there are some reporting requirements we have to go to headquarters or go to the commander to let them know. So the more people you can let know, the better off you are. So once that immediate notification is done, from the time of the mishap, within 7 days, we need that preliminary accident notification sent in, the PAN worksheet that I showed you a few minutes ago. That gives us enough information, if filled out completely, to start our Inglink document to get our stuff going, which is required to be done within the 7 days. After that, Huntsville Center likes, between the time you submit the PAN to get the 3394 to your GDA in Huntsville Center, we like 5 days. And the reason we try to get it not take any longer than that is we want to know that you're looking into the accident while it's still fresh and on your mind, to figure out what the direct and indirect cause and how you're going to control it. So it's better to get that done. Plus, it gives us a little bit of time to send it back and forth if we need to before we send it up for signature. So the timeline is very important to get done, to get that 3394 up and processed through. All right, so here's the definition of a Class A or Class B accident. These require immediate notifications to Huntsville Center or to any of your, wherever your district is, to the KO and to the PM. It's important that this is done. This is a severe accident, and we have some steps that have to be done after this. So if you have an accident where you have a fatality or a permanent partial disability, you have three or more people go to the hospital, or you have an accident with a high dollar amount for property damage, that would be a Class A or Class B. Now, if you don't know for sure, I mean, it's sometimes it varies. You're not sure if it's going to be a Class A or Class B by definition. I would encourage you to train that if it's a severe accident, you want to treat it as a Class A or Class B because some steps have to happen. Number one, make sure, you know, rescue and emergency measures take the top priority when you have an accident. Understood that. After it's settled down, you need to preserve the scene. It shouldn't be disturbed so we can do an accident investigation. So the personnel who are first at the scene, after all the emergency measures have been taken care of, preserve the site and secure it. We will probably have to convene a board of investigation, which is a formal board that we have to get a general officer to sign off on, and we'll start investigating it with a panel. So, and then it talks about any of these requirements. We're not trying, this is just Corps of Engineers. You have other OSHA requirements to notify also, which you should be aware of. All right, just to summarize in another format of what I've tried to say now, if you look at the different classes of these are really recordable accidents, if you have an A or a B, which I talked about what the definition was, you do immediate notification, you get the PAM no later than 8 hours after the accident within 7 days, and then there will be a BOI, and we have 45 days to get all that done, and that's the Corps of Engineers investigation. If you go to a C and a D, it's not immediate notification. You have 24 hours to notify us, and then you have 7 days to get the PAN in. There won't be a BOI, and you still have 45 days per regulation, but a little bit less time frame than that for the Huntsville Center work instructions. Okay, if you go to section 01D05 of EM 38511, you will see that they have in high hazard activities, they want to know right away whether or not you have there was an injury or property damage. If any of these occur in these high hazard activities, there's required to be immediate notification to whatever your POC is, and I have Huntsville Center, I apologize for that, but to the district POC or GDA for your contract. And these, we are required by regulation to give a written investigation to headquarters within 10 days. So in Huntsville Center, we'll get that verbal notification from our contractor, and then we'll decide with them whether we're going to investigate it or they're going to investigate it. But at some point, that report will have to go up to headquarters for that. So that's something that's not – I find that a lot of contractors aren't aware of that. So for Huntsville Center, it depends on the severity of the accidents, whether the Huntsville will investigate or whether we'll ask the contractor to just do a detailed investigation and send the information to us. Again, either way, the contractor is required to notify the GDA within 24 hours of the incident and to do a timely, detailed investigation to determine the root cause. Huntsville Center is required, again, to submit it to headquarters or within 10 days. And so we need a little bit of time in there to review the report and to provide comments to see if we need anything further before we go on to headquarters. Okay, the other one I'd like to highlight during this presentation is near misses. If you go into EM 3511 again, it says that all near misses are required to be reported, and that the definition of a near miss is a mishap that results in no personal injury and zero property damage. But given a shift in time or position, damage or injury may have occurred. So, for example, if you have a crane that swings along around to move its load and just narrowly misses a parked car, or if a worker falls off a scaffolding but's not injured, those would be near misses. So each district has a different way or a different form to report near misses. Hopefully this will change with the new 385 or 3394. Huntsville Center's near miss form is located on the safety office internet site, which I'll show you in a few minutes. But it's very important that you report near misses. Correcting or taking action on any near miss can stop a serious accident from occurring. They're actually a leading indicator which could identify an issue with a safety program or some kind of safety plan. And so it's imperative that as a community of practice is that all the contractors provide this information to us so we can have some statistics on this and send it out to our community of practice, all our other contractors. So I encourage you to do that, and it is a requirement in EM 3511. All right, another one, first aid cases. I personally, Huntsville Center, don't want to see all your first aid treatments. It is required in EM 3511 that all first aid treatments will be maintained and submitted to the GDA upon request. So you should be keeping track of that, and it's very specific in there that you have to talk about the employee's name, the job title, the mishap causes, and corrective actions. So you should be accumulating a list of that, and it actually should be analyzed by the SSHO per the EM. And if I have a if I come out on site or one of my staff comes out on site, they may want to look at that just to see what's going on. But other than that, I don't need to see the first aid cases submitted every time. Just be kept on file per the EM. So just to summarize, really the purpose of investigating the mishap is to learn from the accident, to share information, and to trend for regulation updates. So one thing I have done in the 2 years that I've been here is if I have, depending on the severity of the accident or if I have a reoccurring type accident, is I've asked my staff to develop lessons learned from contractor mishaps. And we do have a small library of lessons learned that's found on the HNC internet site. And there's a location there that you can go and look at that. I think it's very important, again, if we're requiring you to give us this information, that we have some kind of way to share this information and you can learn from what went on somewhere else. So here's the website. It is the internet site. If you you should go to our regular homepage and you'll click down and see Safety Office. You'll go in here. On the right-hand side, it shows my list of lessons learned that I've developed right now. On the left-hand side, it gives you a list of information if you want to know without having to search for it where the ER 3851-99 is. You can go to the safety regulation site. And it also goes into the investigations for the Department of Army 38540. Then you go down to accident reporting. These are the site-specific stuff. If you need, not that we're talking about it here today, but the site visit accident prevention plan is there, or the 3394 that we use, the PAN, and the near-miss worksheets all can be found here. We do try to keep this website updated as much as possible, so that it is usually pretty current information that you can find here. All right, now for the remainder of the time, I want to just go into a little bit of sharing some information on some things that happened. First, I'm going to discuss three accidents that occurred that required a board of investigation. Two of them were from an ordnance and explosive site, and one of them was on a maintenance and service project that we have, but I feel like it could the lessons learned could roll over to a OE site pretty easily. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these, but I do want to at least highlight what occurred and just bring up just a few, not all, but some of the lessons learned that we got from them. The first one was a fatality. It was a subcontractor employee that was working on a maintenance and service contract that we have. He was investigating or troubleshooting elevator doors. For some reason, they weren't working, and he was trying to figure out what was going on. So he had taken his meter to try to see what was going on. He was in the area, had stopped the elevator from going up and down, was inside there trying to check on what was going on by himself. He was using, didn't have any PPE that he should have been wearing for the job, had a metal flashlight in his, we believe was in his mouth, had on a metal watch. He was going to check 120 volts, and in the end it was a fatality. 120 volts did cause a fatality. They don't, based on the autopsy, they don't know the traveling, how the electricity traveled, but it was enough to get him. So basically what happened was he wasn't wearing the required arc flash for 120 volts, and he had on metal that he shouldn't have had on. And then, again, they weren't, AHAs are required to be reviewed as you go out on site, but there was not an AHA for this work that was going on at this location. So I think everybody will say, you know, I've probably worked on 120 volts. So remember, it's not the voltage, it's the current that can kill you. So next one, we had a fatality. A subcontractor was detonating a 40-millimeter projected grenade. They were assisting in some kind of a clearance and excavating the anomalies on a firing range. And they were going in and probing and excavating. And from what I understand, the project was going on for a long period of time. It was hot. It was demanding. And the what actually happened was the use of the prodder caused the death of the employee. And they determined that the direct cause was human error, that he wasn't following procedures, but some of the contributing factors or the indirect causes were complacency, probably exertion due to physical demands, and they weren't getting enough breaks is what the BOI found, and that they probably needed to increase personnel change out and improve training for that. So that was a fatality on site. Next one, on one of our chemical warfare material sites, we were doing a project that was actually low probability. If any of you have done CWM, you know the definition of low probability. They don't feel like they're going to encounter CWM, but there could still be chemical agent in the soil. They were excavating soil. They weren't wearing any kind of respirator, or they didn't have dermal protection. I feel like, and I was not on the board of investigation for this, but I feel like there was probably some complacency. They were still using the monitoring for CWM, but there was complacency that they weren't getting any detection on this, so they felt like everything was okay. But actually what was happening is the workers were encountering odors, and they weren't telling their supervisors that they had it because, you know, they were just on there, and it wasn't there. The mini camps weren't ringing off, so they didn't get training that they should, you know, let them know that they were having odors. So they continued to work while an odor was going on, and in the end, three of them became sick, and they were transported to the hospital. The BOI could not determine what they were exposed to. I think they eliminated CWM, but there are other things out there that can make you sick, so you need to make sure that you have the proper PPE and all the right controls for the project that's going on, and make sure anytime you dig a hole that if workers notice an odor that's unusual, that they stop work and let their supervisors know so you can determine the best path forward on that one. Right. Now I'm going to discuss just a couple mishaps. These are not the severity of the BOIs, but it just is kind of a mix of things that have happened recently on ordnance and explosive sites, and try to just go over some things that we learned from it. First one, we had a mishap on a site. A contractor was stung by approximately 26 times by yellow jackets while he was performing a surface sweep in a very remote area, or in a remote area. At first, the employee was stable, but then the conditions worsened, and I guess it took approximately 50 minutes to get the employee back to the office where first aid procedures were applied. EMS arrived shortly after at the office and gave the employee some medicine, some steroids, and within 4 hours was released to return to work. But you're in a very remote area. Just a reminder that remote areas require first aid attendance and a kit, and per EM-385-11, when medical services are not accessible within 5 minutes of a work location and there are two or more employees at the location, at least two employees shall be qualified to administer first aid and CPR. Now, when we review the accident prevention plan, we're checking to make sure you have a first aid attendant and CPR, but it's important. We don't know, you know, always when reviewing this, what the makeup is or how many different field teams you have. So if you have two of those and they're sitting back at the field trailer and you have two or three of these remote sites, you might want to reconsider that and make sure you're actually complying with the requirement of the first aid attendants on site. Some other things that were found, somebody recommended that they carry wasp spray at all times and you mark locations of nests, and that the AHA really didn't identify that. So any AHA that you submit to Huntsville Center, and I'm sure, I mean, to the Corps, may not identify all the steps. You may find other hazards, but it is a living document. So if you know that there's another hazard in there, you should make sure that you identify that in your AHA and say, okay, wasps, and this is, because this is for the workers, the last line of defense. They should be reviewing this and saying, okay, this is what I need to have on site. So it's important to keep that line of communications open. All right, the second mishap that I'll talk about is involved a UTV. An OE project truck was rear-ended. Or an OE project truck rear-ended a utility vehicle while the pair of vehicles was kind of in an escort formation and they were turning onto the work compound near the end of the work shift. The collision caused damage to both vehicles and resulted in minor injury to the UV driver. So it was late afternoon. There was sun glare. There was unnecessary vehicle traffic and following distance. And it seemed like the police escort might have compounded the issue instead of, or not the, the escort policy added vehicle traffic to the site. So you might just rethink some things when you're doing that. It was a good idea. It just caused some confusion. What we found was these were the outcomes, that there was the operator did have first aid treatment. There was damage to both the UTV and to the truck. So in this case, we didn't get the report. We found out about it later, and it was just logged into the daily report. It's very important that you do notify us. I think the damage to the vehicles was more than the threshold that was required. So what we found was that the operator didn't have formal training. If you look in Section 18A, every person operating a UTV shall be properly trained, qualified, and designated by the employer in writing to operate such equipment. So that wasn't done. That's a process that they were working on changing, and that the AHA didn't address that. So They went back and revisited that. The last mishap I want to talk about was loss of consciousness. So two coworkers were talking, and somebody lost consciousness, hit the head on the table, got a laceration to the face, had a first aid, then he was hospitalized. But the loss of consciousness was determined to be to a health condition. So is this a recordable or reportable incident? It is reportable. It's a good idea to report it, but it isn't recordable because it was a pre-existing condition there. And in there it talks about where that you can find that reference. So that was something that happened from a pre-existing condition. All right, so in summary, remember that both the EM and the ER have training requirements for the supervisors, safety and health officers, and employees on accident reporting investigations, and that the purpose of accident reporting is to gather information to prevent similar accidents from recurring. Like I said, we have a collection of lessons learned on the internet to view, and we use the statistics to change the EM, which is currently up for revision. If we get bad information on the accident form, we have poor information to make decisions. So I encourage you to fill them out as thoroughly and completely as possible, not only for good information, but it's required in the EM, which is referenced in your contract. So there are timelines associated with the mishaps that I went over today. If you're not sure what they are, you can read the EM. Section 1 talks about it pretty clear, and the ER. And if you're not sure, I'd recommend you contact your safety office POC for that, because timeliness is very important in the reporting. Right. Ooh. So this slide did not turn out, but what I was trying to show here was I had a list of all our accidents that have occurred in FY18 for all of Huntsville contractors, and what I was trying to show here was that our number one mishap for FY18 was cut by. So we have approximately of all our recordables, I think we had 7 out of 29, if I remember right. We're having cut-bys. We get lacerations to the thumb, leg, to the face, to most body parts. But what we're finding, at least is reported, is it's due to improper use or placement of a tool or not using the proper PPE. Our second injury that occurs or mishap is fall from the same level, and when we look at that, we're having unkept work areas or environmental causes such as slippery or icy work conditions of some kind. And the other thing I wanted to point out, which I think is important to point out in ordnance and explosives, is that we have had 2 heat stress cases in Huntsville Center in FY18. And it's important to remember that you guys have to have a heat stress program that you implement in the field, whether you're in putting somebody in a level C PPE or if you've just got them in level D and they're out there working. At some point, you're required to trigger that heat stress. And I think a lot of times, I know for chemical warfare material sites, they have programs and it's very regimented. I'm not as sure for conventional. I don't get on as many of those. But if you don't, you should have that and make sure that they're following that.
So then I wanted I should have the image up, the one that's missing. Can you see it now on the screen?
No, ma'am. It came up for a second.
Okay, and it's still not back up there for you?
No. But I can talk through it.
Okay. All right, and for those on the audience, we do have a temporary placement. You can see it. So just so you know, Kelly, the audience can see it. The screen is up there, and when you're ready to move on, I'll take down this temporary fix, and you can move on with the slides.
Okay. Well, I will try to keep talking from – I don't have all the visual cues, but I'll try to keep comping from my memory then. If you notice on the bottom left, one thing I wanted to point out was that HNC has experienced slightly more contractor accidents than the prime contractor. And the EM clearly discusses that the prime is responsible for all workers on site. And I just want to remind you guys, as prime contractors, watch out for your subcontractors. If they have an accident, it comes all the way back up. It's a Corps of Engineer accident. So it's important that you're managing those subs as much as your own workers. We don't want anybody to get hurt, and that your safety culture extends all the way down to the subs and not just to your workers. So then finally, on the top, I guess on the top right, you have the safety triangle. I guess I had that mixed up earlier. I apologize. I wanted to point that out. I think we've had 2 fatalities, 29 injuries recordable, and maybe 6 near misses on that triangle. If you go back to safety, the safety pioneer, Mr. Heimrich, he developed a concept known as the safety triangle. And in this, he theorized that for every fatality, there were 29 injuries and 300 near misses. And that the key to avoiding injuries and fatalities is to capture and correct at the near miss stage. So if you look, if we've had 2 fatalities, we should have had more reported, nearly 60 or 600 near misses reported. And I think we've had 6. So as I said earlier, near misses are leading indicators, and reporting and training these helps us prevent serious accidents. So it's not only reported by the EM, but it's very important for us to trend that as a Huntsville Center. So I just encourage you all to send out your near misses. I know the next presentation, Neil Feist is going to talk about a near miss. That was a pretty serious one. So there's a different severity, you know, based on near misses, but it's important that these are done so we can stop the severe accidents from happening. Okay, we can move to the next slide, please. All right, so in summary, USACE requires that all mishaps are reported, from serious accidents to a first aid case. You guys are required to submit a thorough, timely, and complete investigation, which identifies a root cause, direct and indirect factors. All of the mishaps have reporting forms and timelines that are required to met, and they're all spelled out either in the EM or the ER. In addition to these regulations require training to a certain level, of whether it's your SSHO, your supervisor, or your employee. And I think it's very important, if you haven't done it as a corporate, that you should go to Section 1 of the EM and read through that, where you have the very hard and fast safety rules and regulations from 2 on through the rest of the EM. Section 1 sets the framework for your program on a Corps of Engineers site and how you're supposed to manage it. So it's important that you know what those requirements are. So finally, you know, USACE requires that near misses as the leading indicators be reported, and we're really not seeing that to date. We're not seeing the number of near misses we would expect to see given our contractor exposure hours and the number of serious accidents that we've had. So I just want to say it's very important that you do that. So thank you. I hope that you got something out of this today. And that concludes my presentation.
Great job, Kelly. Hey, hang on the line for a second. We've got a couple questions I need to run past you. First question is ER 385-199 being revised? If so, when can we expect the revision to be published?
It is, to my knowledge, there is some planning for it to be revised. I don't know that they have gotten very far on that. I believe that the first thing you will see out is the new 3394, and once that's out, then they will start working again on 385-1-99.
Perfect. Next question. If you have an accident with multiple people involved, do you need to fill out a separate PAN and 3394 for each person? And kind of an attachment question, I think, on this one. Go ahead and answer that one first, and then we'll hit with the next one.
Yes, there needs to be one for each one. They can reference each other back, but there's certain information for each for that. It just needs to all be tied back.
All right, perfect. The other question up here comes, it's not really laid out too well, but it says differs from the OSHA definition. OSHA says one or more to the hospital. So I'm not kind of don't really see the question in there, kind of more of a statement. And I think it pertains to the question I just asked. But, okay, that's all we've got for question-wise. And what we'll do is we'll press on to the next presentation. Next presenter is Neil Feist. He's with HGL. And Neil, you on the line?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Absolutely. His presentation is near misses.
Thanks, Jeff. As Jeff said, my name is Neil Feist. I've been with HGL for about a little over 6 years. I've actually worked in the MMRP industry for, I'm ashamed to say it, but over 25 years. And prior to that, I was Air Force EOD for a little over 6 years. What I'm going to talk about is one particular near miss that HGL had on a Huntsville project. As Kelly mentioned, we considered it, as did Huntsville, a pretty serious one. This slide, again, the definition of a near miss, how OSHA defines it. Kelly went over that, and she talked about investigating a high ratio of near misses helps find the causal factors, and it should result in about a 95 reduction in actual losses. And this is all per OSHA. But notice it says a high ratio of near misses. A previous employer that I had, we had quotas for near misses, for reporting near misses. And so, every office had a certain quota that they had to meet at each month. And, I think, and this is just my opinion, I think sometimes you end up with near-miss reports that aren't really relevant or that don't necessarily meet the definition of what a near-miss is. So, I think, as Kelly said, reporting them are important, excuse me, but they need to meet the definition for them to be relevant to the to help you reduce losses. So on to the project where we had the near-miss. The background of the project, it was an RIFS in an area surrounding an active OD range. This range, hey, Gene, can you throw the green arrow up for me? The range they used, as an OD to dispose of Code H or unserviceable munitions, it had a net explosive weight limit of 1,000 pounds per shot. So here's, the operational area where they do the demolition. And then this line here would be what is their exclusion zone during demolition. And they would tamp or bury the shots prior to blowing them. So that's a little background on the site. It was a typical RIFS. We did site preparation, transects, grids, DGM grids. And all during the field work, we coordinated closely with the installation and the operational range folks for access and control. And all of our field work was closely coordinated so that the range was inactive when we were working. And then once we completed intrusive operations, we scheduled the soil sampling. Normally, we would try to do that during the intrusive operations, but there was some delays for the sampling. So we went out there a week or so after. On to the next slide here. So the incident that occurred, I'm done with the arrow, thank you. The project team scheduled 2 days with the range scheduler at the installation and range control for this event. So they scheduled a Monday and a Tuesday. They scheduled well ahead of time with the scheduler, and then when they arrived at the installation, they checked in with range control, had a verbal conversation with them, confirmed that they would be on site for both days, and range control informed our team that there was no activities, no demolition activities scheduled for either of those days. The primary reason for checking in with range control was to get the radio. So they were issued the radio, and they went on into the site to collect their samples. Hey, Gene, I want to go back. Can I have the arrow again? Thank you. Sorry about that. So the sample locations are these locations here. So you can see some of them are fairly close to the actual what they establish as their exclusion zone. On the other side, which there were some that were even closer than this one. Okay, I'm done with the arrow. Thanks. So, so at the end of the first day, you know, the team went out, they did their sampling. At the end of the day, about 5:15, there was no one at range control to check out with, so they went on back, shipped their samples, went on back to the hotel. On day two, they arrived about 7:15, and there was no one at range control. The assumption was no one's at range control because the range isn't active. So they went on and started conducting their sampling. So at about 9:15 on day two, the range radio started indicating that there was low battery. So they stopped what they were doing. They wanted to go back down to range control to change out the battery of the radio. And as they once they got their gear loaded, they started to head down the hill to range control, and there was a detonation. And it, you know, within the open detonation area. By this time, the radio had completely died. So the team drove away from the detonation, I imagine rather quickly, got themselves to a location high with, you know, elevated location within the site, and called the environmental office, who was our client's client. Huntsville was, you know, was working for the base environmental office. So the environmental office in turn called range control via phone, and they stopped the, by that time, four detonations had occurred, which was essentially all of the detonations that they had set. But they gave our folks a verbal that it was all clear to drive back down to range control. So when they got to range control, it was determined that our team was actually given a radio with the incorrect frequency. Apparently, the installation had two different sets of radios. I believe they were in the process of converting from analog to digital, so there was two different frequencies. It wasn't clear to actually anyone which frequency they were operating on, except for the people that were doing the work. The range didn't follow their procedures for checking their exclusion zones, one of which was to drive the perimeter roads. Had they done that, they would have noticed our people because it was our vehicle was parked on a primary range road, a primary perimeter road. They didn't broadcast or announce the demolition operations, at least not on our radio, and the manager back over on the main side of the base did not hear the broadcast about conducting demolition operations. And then that final bullet, they just forgot we were there, which when our teams got back down there, it was obvious to them that just the fact that they conducted demolition operations was obvious that they forgot we were there. So from the reporting perspective, one thing I'll mention is, I wasn't aware that HNC had a near-miss form, but I guess all of us on the phone, thanks to Kelly's presentation, are now aware that it exists. So our sample team, as I said earlier, they immediately contacted the environmental office. Our PM contacted the Huntsville PM/COR, and then did her reporting within the company. And then the OESS that was assigned to that project, I think he was busy with another project, so I couldn't reach him, so I got a hold of Ms. Bettina Johnson. And then she tracked him down. We prepared the near-miss report and submitted it. The HNC actually sent that to us. And then Bettina Johnson and Kelly Williams, set up a meeting with us, so with HGL, the sample team, myself, and I think OE Safety may have attended as well, but I don't remember. And we talked. Actually, we had more than one meeting, and we talked, you know, discussed why we thought it happened. And I believe I'm quite certain that Huntsville had discussions with the installation as well. So the what and why, what happened? It's obvious. Demolition operations were conducted while the range was scheduled for sampling by HGL. They had no formal check-in and check-out procedure at range control, and if they did have one, they didn't follow it. Even during the majority of our field operations, there was really no daily check-in or check-out with the range. Our safety guy would go by there, but you know they wouldn't be there early in the morning when we got on site, so he'd stop in there sometime during the morning and just check in with them, but it wasn't like a formal check-in, check-out process. And the range personnel didn't follow their SOP regarding securing the exclusion zone. And I think this is the Military Munitions Support Services Group, so my assumption is that everyone that's on this call works in the munitions arena or supports it as a subcontractor by some means. One of the cardinal rules when you blow stuff up is to make sure that your exclusion zone is clear so that you don't hurt anybody. So the lessons learned for us, while most active ranges, you know, have really strict access and control procedures, this particular range had procedures, but they weren't strictly adhered to. And, you know, while we don't think our team did anything wrong, there's things they could have done better. And one of those is to, up front, establish and agree to check in and check out procedures at the kickoff and every time we enter a range, in particular if there's no formal procedures. We should have taken additional steps to make sure that the radio they handed us was the one that they would be broadcasting on, conduct radio checks even if they're not required, check in every day with range control. If they're not there, check in with the POC for the installation. And internally, we've added requirements to our readiness review that if we're, because we work on a lot of active ranges doing the MILCON removal actions, most of those really truly do have strict procedures, but internally we're requiring our staff, if they're working in or near a range, that they will establish those check-in and check-out procedures or follow the existing ones. That's really it. Mine's short and sweet.
Oh, awesome, Neil. Hey, we got some questions for actually that popped up, and a couple of these are back for Kelly. Kind of go back over what we had before. Let's see here. Okay, let's see. We did Josh's there. Sorry about that. How do we deal with HIPAA requirements if we are putting names on the action reports? Kelly, still on?
I am still on. The name can be on the accident report. We just don't need any of the HIPAA requirements on there. I don't need any of the medical details. So I'm not sure. I mean, we still need the name, but I don't need any of the PII or PHI associated with that.
Okay. And here's, let's see. There's that one. Actually, that's all the questions we've got. So, sorry about that. And the next speaker we're going to have is Bettina Johnson. She's one that kind of put all those presentations together, and she wants to talk about HNC a little bit. So, Bettina?
Okay, so I am Bettina Johnson. I am the division chief over the Military Munitions Design Center here at Huntsville Center. We also have four other design center chiefs within the Corps of Engineers. Currently, that's Ralph Campbell, who is the design center chief for the Chemical Warfare Material Design Center here in Huntsville. Monique Osterman, who is the design center chief there at the SPD Range Center. Mike Rogers, who's the Baltimore Design Center chief. And then we also have the Omaha Design Center Chief, which that is Laura Persifield. So it's really important, even though we maintained a more central focus on Huntsville Center's work here during these presentations, the criticality of it is that, you know, we want to tell you that safety is everyone's responsibility. If you see something, you need to say something. And safety is also a team effort. Take your morning safety briefings very seriously, as we have all, you know, some of us has worked in the field before. We know that it's really early in the morning, and when we're having those safety briefings, it's sometimes tough to concentrate, but they're covering items that are in the work plan and the accident prevention plan that will help you to do your job safely. You know, I want to make sure that you know that each design center has similar requirements or the same requirements in some aspects to reporting any mishaps, near misses, or accidents or incidents. So please take it, as we've said here today, that we are treating this very seriously. We've been very fortunate since the time that we began doing projects, whether it was the formerly used defense site or even doing work on active installations. To keep our accidents, mishaps, near misses, and other serious incidents to a minimum, and we want to keep it that way because that's part of our way to do our business safely. The work that you execute for us is important to our USAIS, DOD, and even the public communities, and we want to maintain a safety-focused mentality for our work to be completed. We really appreciate you participating in this webinar and want you to keep safety in the forefront of your minds and always strive to complete your work in the safest manner possible. If there's a question that you have about all the content that has been covered today, please feel free to send that information back through either Jeff Brewer, or if you need to reach out and talk to your design center chiefs regarding the specifics as it relates to their contract, the contract that you're currently under. One thing that we need to keep in mind, you know, we've had several areas that have experienced flooding and hurricanes here recently. So there's even more potential for us to have slips, trips, and falls in those areas where we have a lot of debris that was typically not on our site before then. And also fires and several other issues that we've had out west. So please make sure that you're keeping a safe environment and keeping your area clean so that your workers can do their job appropriately and safely. And that's really all I have.
All right, thanks, Bettina. I'm running into some technical issues here for some reason. I see the clock counting down at the bottom, but I can't really do anything. And so, Gene, can you go ahead and put up my slides if they're not already up?
Yep, your closing up there.
All righty, let's see here. Basically, guys, that concludes our presentation. We are looking, like I said earlier, to do our next webinar, be mid to late in February, and that would be on the new QAP toolkit that's coming out, if you all are involved with using that. And so that's going to be a really outstanding one. Some of the questions, don't see, I know Gene just sent me some questions here, I think, but I think we got rid of all those. So again, sorry about some of the technical stuff. I'll have Gene send me some. If there's any final questions you have, go ahead and type them in there. Gene can email those to me, and then I can get them to the presenter, and we can get those questions answered for you. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and conclude this last webinar. And Gene, if there's anything you have.
All right. Thanks so very much, Jeff. I'll go ahead and walk through just a few final reminders for today's broadcast before we close things out. Again, we do apologize for the technical issue that we had with a few of the organizers here, but as noted, we'll be sure to pass along any questions that you all might have entered into the Q&A window and share those with our organizers. So hopefully we can get information passed on to you after today's live broadcast. Just want everyone to know that I can see all of your questions and comments coming into that Q&A window, so please don't worry, they are being collected, and we'll be sure to save those after today's live broadcast and pass them on your behalf. When we started today's broadcast, we let everybody know that copies of the presentation material as well as contact information for our presenters and organizers are currently posted on the seminar homepage. So for those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation content or looking for ways to reach out with additional questions, I encourage you to browse over to the seminar homepage or follow the links on the middle right of your screen. Again, we have materials available on the seminar resources page. So simply find it on the middle right of your screen under related URLs. Click that link to the seminar resources and then press the browse to button. That website should open up and you'll be able to access materials for today's session, and then also check out several other areas, including contact information for our presenters. Our session was also recorded today, so if you're looking to share this information with a coworker or colleague, you'll receive an email in approximately 1 week as soon as the archive is available, and you'll be welcome to forward that email on so that others can replay it on demand. One of the most common questions we receive at Cluin is if we offer CEUs or PDHs for our training. While we don't issue those types of credits for these webinars, we do offer participation certificates for those of you who join us and then fill out an optional online feedback form. So if you're looking for one of these certificates, I would ask each of you to take just a moment to fill out our brief online feedback form and let us know what you thought about our delivery today, both in the method that we used to deliver it as well as the content that was covered. When you fill out that form, please pay close attention. Make sure you enter your name correctly, your own email address correctly, and then check a box that appears at the very bottom of it. You see a snapshot of this box in the upper right of this slide. That box certifies when you check it that you were either here for the entire live session or you replayed the entire recorded webinar. And so when you submit that feedback form in, after checking that box, you'll immediately have access to a participation certificate that looks something like the example on the screen. You can either save that or print it out for your own records. If you happen to be participating as a group in a conference room, each one of you can fill out that feedback form to get your own certificate, regardless of who actually registered for the session. So if one of your coworkers signed up and you just joined them in the room, as long as you can get the link from them, fill it out later on and get your own certificate for your own records. And as I noted, if you're watching the recorded version, you can still get credit and print out one of those certificates. Simply follow the links on the middle right of your screen, browse through that feedback form. You can still fill it out based off the archive and get a certificate for replaying that session. So that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's session. So I want to thank the nearly 90 individuals who joined us from across the U.S. for today's live broadcast. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that you'll join us on a future Cluin webinar. As noted, this will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much.